I was younger and I wanted to go into the creative industry, I did not even give myself the chance to even try it because I was like, I'm already not good enough. So I let that stop me. And I feel like if I could go back and redo that, I would have been kinder to myself.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Going Places. This is a podcast aimed to give you clarity on your creativity because you, my friend, are going places. This is a continuation of my Patreon-only podcast, which is me sharing what I know. But these three episodes are me sitting down with someone who inspires me and asking them what they know. This is basically just an excuse for me to sit down and chat to people who I want to speak to. And I'm so excited to share this episode with you today. Today on the podcast, we have got Ananya, an illustrator and activist who uses her work as a tool to speak truth to voices of marginalized communities at the intersection of disability, race, and gender. Ananya's work feels so warm and is joyful while also being incredibly educational and fighting for marginalized communities. She has worked with some amazing clients, including the BBC, Hallmark, the Tate, Adobe, Refinery29, and many, many more. In this episode, we discussed a higgledy-piggledy journey to a creative career, money, and all of the things us artists need to know when it comes to money, and how the creative industry really needs to change and become more accessible. So let's get into the episode. What was your relationship like with creativity when you were little?
I love this question. It's so cute. And I was quite a shy child. I think I was pretty nerdy from like a young age. So I just kind of had like all my toys. The most important thing for me was definitely my sketchbooks. Like I feel like I just went through them so quickly. And I remember one of the first things that I drew as like a really young kid was flowers with chalk on a chalkboard. And that kind of was the start of like a really like wonderful obsessive relationship with art and drawing. And at the time I used to love drawing like my family. I was like really obsessed with animals. I was a horse girl, so I used to draw horses a lot as well. And it was kind of like my little private time to kind of create my own little worlds and like imagine stories that would go with all these characters that I was creating. And it really always just felt like a huge part of who I am and who I've grown up to be. I think that kind of that level of like obsession around art like really maintained itself throughout school as well. But as kind of I got encouraged to kind of go into academia a lot and focus on like my studies, and that's where sometimes it fell by the wayside a little bit, and I didn't really get to pursue what I wanted to, which at the time was graphic design and animation. I would have loved to have done that.
Yeah, that's so I love a horse girl. I remember those. But yeah, I think that's what was that decision like when you went into more academia? Was that difficult?
It was really tough, actually. It felt like a really hard decision on top of kind of going through all the exams and like making university choices. I was alongside being a horse girl, I was also a dinosaur nerd, so I used to draw dinosaurs a lot as well. And I just remember crying because I was like, I really want to go into like paleo art, which is specifically creating art to accompany like paleontological articles around dinosaurs. It's very specific, but at the time it was like what I was really passionate about, versus like going down like a more academic route and going into like history or something like that. And I just didn't have very much confidence. Like I was quite shy. I'd been bullied for like a long time in school as well. So I just didn't really think that I would ever be good enough at art or creating art to pursue it. So I decided to go into history. I felt like it was like more tangible, you know, when you have exam results that are saying like, oh, you know, you got X percentage in your exam, so therefore you are good at this. So I was like, okay, well, then I probably have a better chance of doing well at university in that. And that's the route I took.
I mean, it's so that I think that story is like a higgledy-piggledy way into the creative industry is like so common. And I think that, I mean, I'll ask you more about that, like what you studied and how that influenced your creativity later. But I do think it's fascinating to me, because I think we need so there are so many people who did have a higgledy-piggledy way into the creative arts and have successful careers, and I think we need to hear more of those stories. So it's like, I don't know, I find that really fascinating. And I think as well, like, it's so, I think that makes your artwork so strong that you've got this like background of so much knowledge. And yeah, I think it's a because I think I chose graphic design because I was too afraid to be an illustrator. And it's so, I also saw like more of a tangible like way to earn money as a designer rather than an artist. But when did you realize that you could make a living off your illustrations?
That's a really good question. That came a lot later down the line. Like, I would say that was fairly recently, because I've just passed by 1 month my year's mark of being a full-time freelance illustrator. Ooh! Which is, yay!
Congratulations.
Yeah, so really the journey into illustration has been, like, as you said, it was very higgledy-piggledy for me. So it's actually all of these questions and realizations have been super recent. I feel like I started to realize that I could make money out of my artwork and illustrations. It was, I would say, 2019. I actually got into illustration on the back of an accident, which resulted in me getting a brain injury. And I took 6 months or so out of work. So I couldn't work at all, but I could create art. So I started doing watercolor paintings. And a couple of those I submitted to a local gallery for like a joint exhibition, and it was so much fun, and you know, people were buying my prints and I had so much positive feedback, and I just started to kind of, I guess, believe in myself a bit more and realize that, you know, it's something that makes me happy, but it's also something that people see and kind of see a piece of me through my art, and, you know, want to display it in their homes and things like that, which I thought was really wild. So that kind of catapulted me into kind of starting to create more regularly and also starting to sell art prints. So I created an Etsy account. I started to kind of just talk about it more. I created an Instagram. And that's when I started to kind of basically, I'm quite like, I guess, a structured person in terms of how I deal with things financially as well. So at that time, I started to kind of record all of my all of the money that I was getting from selling my art, to kind of almost like build a case study for myself, you know. And that took me all the way to when I eventually quit my job, which was when I was like, great, actually, the amount of money that I'm making supersedes the amount that I'm earning in my day job. So goodbye to that.
Oh, I love that. And I think that that's the thing as well, because I speak to so many aspiring creators who are like, when is the time to go freelance? And I always say, when you know that you can make money and having those, that kind of awareness, and I love that you made like a case study for yourself and to looking at the numbers, especially when creative people can be so like, I'm just gonna do this thing now. And so yeah, looking at numbers I think is so important. And yeah, I'd love to ask you about organization, because I am working on that part myself. But your work, I mean, your work is so personal and so much of you is in the work. Did you start to have those conversations with people who were buying your art, and what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually my artwork became like that because it, from the very beginning, it was very embedded with, you know, the fact that I'd had this accident and I was dealing with becoming disabled and thinking about what that means to me. And also, you know, exploring other themes and experiences that I'd have had as, you know, a woman of color, and thinking about my activism as well. So I feel like all of those themes that I was trying to talk about and communicate through my art at that time. And a lot of people really picked up on that. And I remember one of the kind of first gallery exhibitions I did, someone reviewed the exhibition and they were saying how, you know, there's a lot of beauty to my artwork, but also at the same time that it kind of subtly challenges people in different ways and kind of prompts people into thinking about, you know, the lived realities of disability or, you know, racism and like specific kind of like white male gaze. That was one theme that I was exploring a lot at the time. So I had a lot of really positive feedback about it. Equally, I think some people kind of, I've had some people feel a little bit uncomfortable occasionally, but that's kind of the rare occasion. But, you know, I view that as an opportunity to kind of make conversation about it and challenge people's perspectives and get people to understand that discomfort and uncomfortable conversations are not something that we should shy away from, but something that's important when we're trying to facilitate change.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love all the topics that you cover in your work. And I think there's something so beautiful about your work because, I mean, your style is so warm and inviting, and it just has this wonderful, like, warmness is like the best way I feel when I look at your work. And then talking about these difficult things and bringing those two things together just works so beautifully. Do you feel like the style of work allows you to talk about those things easier, or like, I don't know, engage people in a different way?
First of all, thank you for saying that my work is warm. That means a lot to me. I do want to kind of convey like a warm, fuzzy feeling often. So I'm so glad that you said that. but yeah, I do think that there's, I mean, for me, I have always been really interested in like the specific aesthetics around creating artwork and illustration. In my specific medium. So, you know, like I'm really particular and I love experimenting with color palettes. I love it when things work, you know. I've always been interested in like drawing bodies and like creating, like putting a lot of, I guess, like love, warmth, and all of those kind of energies into my work. And I don't want people to think that that can't coexist with also challenging people and you know, using your work to influence people from an activist kind of perspective, because I think that at the end of the day, what we all want, like, you know, within the social justice movement is to create a world that facilitates those things more, right? Like we want more joy for marginalized communities. We want to kind of explore so much more than just like, I just think that often, especially when we think of visual representations of social justice issues that we're trying to talk about, we often pigeonhole communities into, you know, I'm thinking especially around disability, you know, like the kind of either the inspirational disabled person or like the disabled person that's just really sad and always in a hospital bed. And it's like, it's so 2D and it's so you're like essentializing our experiences that are such a broad range of things. So I like to kind of think about like everyday moments of joy, and kind of really capturing that in my work. And I think that the two can, you know, perfectly exist together, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the most beautiful things about your work is there's so much celebration, there's so much joyfulness, as well as talking about things that are really important and change that needs to happen. And I think you're right. Like, well, yeah, you're definitely right. I don't think you're right in terms of like all of that, like it needs to, it can coexist. And I think the joy from marginalized groups as well is as important in terms of like radical change that needs to happen so that we can, you know, celebrate all of it. And And I think that, yeah, it's so beautiful. I think those two things 100%, you know, come together so beautifully in your work. And I know that I have this little quote from doing my little research, having a little stalk. And, and I love this quote that you said in the Creative Boom article that I'll leave linked in the description of this podcast. And I'm just going to read it because then I have some questions that come from it. You said, "For me, my art is a form of activism. It enables me to communicate ideas on social justice in a way that is accessible, emotive, and easy to understand. Before my brain injury, my activism was much centered around social justice issues. I don't feel able to write in the way I used to, so naturally art became my method of doing activism. I have a background in history and anthropology, where I focused on writing about descent against fascism in India. I'm no longer an academic, but I feel strongly about using the research tools I trained in to ensure my illustrations are community focused and reflect the lived experiences of people from marginalized communities." And the whole article is amazing, so definitely give it a full read. But reading this, I had so many more questions to ask you, and I wanted to start about like pivoting and transitioning from one thing to another thing, particularly after going through something that feels maybe out of your control. And I know that a couple of people have that I've mentored and I've spoken to have asked me questions about like pivoting and I think as well the, well, I'll start with the first question. How was that process like for you? And I know that you talked about how art was such a passion from a young age. So was it that you were following just your passion? But yeah, how was that process to like pivot and transition from one thing to another thing?
Yeah, I think that in a way, I was very lucky to have had the time during my brain injury to be able to explore it without any constraints around work and, you know, life expectations. You know, I recognized that I was fully just at home, not able to do much, totally done with podcasts. No offense. I mean, I love podcasts now, but at the time I was like, I have listened to everything.
I completed podcasts.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, Apple Podcast is done. So I think that I had the time, and the lack of pressure from like having to go to work and things like that really helped me to kind of just feel like I could explore artwork again, without feeling any need to kind of perform for anyone. It was kind of just for me at the time, and that was quite a nice thing to do for myself. I think that what I decided that I wanted to do with my artwork when I was looking to kind of pivot, and when I started to realize, oh, I actually really want this to be, you know, a fixture in my life and actually my focus, was that I started to think, so I felt like that the way that I'd explored art as a child and at school was like very much from like a just a passion perspective, and just that I enjoyed actually drawing. And then now, you know, me as an adult and someone who had come out of academia, I had like quite a strong activist background as well. Like I wanted to kind of put all of those life experiences and all of my new passions as an adult into the work that I was creating. And also I was very conscious that, you know, art can be such a powerful tool for communication and communicating ideas. And so that's where I really deliberately decided that I wanted it to be like a tool for activism. And I think I saw, you know, I was very much inspired by other artists and creatives that I saw doing similar things, talking about their lived experiences, whether that be as like queer people of color or, you know, Black lived experiences, trans lived experiences, etc., and all the intersections. I also saw that there wasn't that much, I couldn't find that much from a visual perspective about disability, and especially being a disabled person of color. So I think that I found a niche when I pivoted. It was really important to me to like have a direction. Like, you know, I'd been through quite a lot of different careers. It wasn't like that I wasn't used to pivoting. Just for context, like I really moved a lot. I started out in academia and I was, you know, I really wanted to go and do a PhD and become a lecturer. It was not good for my mental health. So I was like, I need to leave. And I did. And then I went into sales and consulting, which turned me from being quite a shy person into feeling more able to do things like talk on the phone and talk about money, which is really helpful. And I pivoted again, went into a different type of consulting, which is more like market research. And then I pivoted again and ended up in marketing and actually worked my way up to becoming a marketing director. And that it was from that position that I then fully pivoted into illustration. So for me, I didn't feel afraid necessarily of pivoting into the role of illustrator because I felt like I had done that quite a few times previously in my career path. But the thing that I kind of maintained and told myself a lot back then when I kept changing career was that if it doesn't feel good and it doesn't sit right with you, then it might not be for you. I think that it's personally speaking, but also I think a lot of people feel this way, is that you end up turning on yourself when you get the urge to transition or you don't feel like you're doing well in a job. And often, you know, if you're not doing well in a job, it's not that there's something wrong with you. It's not that you're not capable enough. It's often just that that's not the best fit. And I felt this passion that I hadn't felt before when I was illustrating. And I decided to follow that and be a bit more intuitive about it.
Oh, I love that. And I read a long time ago now that the average person, I mean, this has probably changed now to a higher number, but the average person, I think it was like 2015, has like about 6 or 7 different jobs. And I think that's something that, yeah, that it reigns true for me. I have definitely changed and careers a few times. And I feel like every experience has only allowed me to become a better and stronger like creative business as well as an illustrator. And I think I love that you said that about the one of the jobs gave you confidence that you felt like you could speak on the phone, and all these other little changes can help you. I feel like can, even though they, you just learn as you go and try and figure things out. And I feel like every experience I've had in different jobs, especially customer service jobs, have taught me so much about so many things. And I speak to a lot of people who are so afraid of failure. And I think taking like a jump to change in order to try and find something that does feel right can be such a scary thing. I definitely felt the fear. And I think there's a lot of, like you said, like if you don't do it, you feel like you're going against yourself. And that like gut intuition it can be often like telling us what we need to do. But I think, how do you feel about, do you feel like all those experiences have given you more information and more like learning experience to get you to where you are?
For sure. In a way, I feel like, I don't know, I feel like things happen for a reason, essentially. And I don't know if I would have been ready to jump into illustration when I was fresh out of school. I feel like I learned a whole lot from, you know, doing my social sciences degrees and then spending some time in the corporate world as well. Like I started out as an illustrator already being a very confident person in a lot of ways. And I think that, you know, when I was going through university, et cetera, like I was extremely underconfident. I really didn't have any self-esteem. And I think when you're in a career like illustration, where often what you create is so personal to you, if you're a perfectionist and if you have low self-esteem, that can be so tough. So actually I'm grateful that I went through those experiences, but also that I think that I integrate them quite well into being an illustrator. So from the perspective of like having learned anthropology and history, I think that I include a lot of those methods in terms of how I approach illustration. So like often I will do a little bit of like market research and ask people's opinions and make sure that there's, you know, I'm thinking about who am I trying to represent in these illustrations, and like, and you know, what are their lived experiences? And I'll actually like go out and ask the community. Like, I usually use Twitter for that a lot because people are really responsive. From like a sales and marketing perspective, that's helped me a lot on the business side of things, right? Like, I know that certainly a lot of people that I know who are also illustrators, some things that I think is quite a common struggle is talking about money, asking for more money, you know, managing the business side of things, the admin, marketing yourself, like that. I feel like I really was able to learn that and hone that through the various jobs that I had previous to becoming an illustrator. And it really helped me to kind of view illustration from a business perspective, as well as like the personal reward that I get and the passion related reward that I get from being an illustrator.
Oh, 100%. And I think having all those jobs, and especially a job in marketing, I can imagine it was, I mean, I had a job in marketing and it was so helpful. I think it was, I had like an internship in a marketing agency, and I think those, yeah, it's super, super helpful. And I think that's what I have definitely spoken to young people where I'm like, if you haven't got loads of clients on your door right away and not a portfolio and you're trying to build things on, you know, slowly, I think there is such a rush. I definitely got told like, have a little bit of patience and gather all those experiences, and so they will make you a better and stronger business owner. And what you said about self-esteem, oh, I've seen that so many times, and how, because I spend all my time alone. That's why I wanted to do this podcast, to speak to people that inspire me as well, and to like, I don't know, have chats about creativity. But yeah, you're right, if you're already feeling struggling with confidence and self-esteem, if a client goes, can you change these things, it's like, oh. And you need that self-belief. And I guess as well as working within companies, that other side of the coin, when you're working with clients and trying to make campaigns and trying to like the business side of things, I think I always say to myself and to other people, like, it's business, it's not personal. And yeah, we can talk about money. I love talking about money. I know that that's a lot of people, that things that I get asked, and I'm sure you do too, about making money and how to, I guess, make it, make the money.
Make the money.
Do you have any specific pieces of wisdom in terms of like negotiation or even charging or multiple revenue streams and passive income and all these kind of businessy terms?
all about doing business.
Yes, the biz.
Yeah, for sure. I think one thing that I decided quite early on, just when I was first kind of establishing myself as an illustrator, I was thinking a lot about like, okay, how do I want to like charge for my work? I think one thing that I decided at that point was that I was not going to have a day rate, unless maybe I was doing a workshop or something like that. But even then, I don't have a day rate. And the reason why is because I think that they're a massive catch-22. Like, if you are a fast illustrator, and like, I'm quite fast, I know that you said that you're really fast as well. Like, what? So you're going to finish something that could take someone else like 4 hours in 1 hour, and then you get paid a quarter of the amount. Like, that doesn't feel fair at all. And I think that it kind of goes, yeah, it's just, it's ridiculous. So I don't tend to charge by the hour or as a day rate. What I think is more valuable, and I think that actually, what's the word? I think that this is the best way to represent the value that illustration has to clients, is thinking about like value-based pricing. And that sounds kind of like weird, but what it is that it's often used in consulting a lot. And essentially, you think about the project that you're being briefed on and asked to do, and you might think about like, what does my illustration carry in terms of the value for the project? Like, it's not just thinking about how long the illustration took you. It's thinking like, okay, so this this brand or this client is going to be using my work to communicate like a certain message in this project. It's going to be global. It's going to be on their social media. It's going to be X, Y, and Z. Like that's a ton of value that I'm adding to it. And so you can use that to inform how you want to charge for the project. So the way that I usually do that is I will charge per project. I usually have like an idea of maybe like a base kind of rate for what I do for like similar projects. And I'll also then consider, I think there are always like factors that should be considered when you're pricing for clients as well, like that like definitely you do every time. So for example, like the size of the client, like are they a really cute small little, I don't know, local pastry shop that doesn't have a big budget, and you're like, oh, that's sweet. Okay, cool. Like, I won't charge you like thousands and thousands because you can't afford that. Or is it like a really big, like well-known brand, or like a social media network, or like organization that has like a huge, like multi-million revenue turnaround per year, and you know that their budget is way bigger. And then obviously you've got to think about things like what kind of licensing they want, like where will your illustration, like where will your illustration appear? And then also the scope in terms of the usage. So like, is it worldwide? Is it just in the UK? And all of those things should inform the amount that you quote for specific jobs, for sure. And I think what I do every single time, and it's really, really important, is do not feel afraid to ask about the budget up front. I feel like a lot of clients withhold the budget in the hopes that you will give them a quote first that's far lower, and then they'll be like, haha, I actually had a way bigger budget, but psych, now you're in the project with like your original quote, so like whatever. So I don't think I ever have entered into a project without knowing the budget first. I will just insist, even if they're like, oh, but if you could just pop over something, I'll be like, oh, that's great. Well, can you just pop over the budget first? And then they're like, well, if you could just, and I'll be like, no, the budget first, please. And it's like, awkward. It's so awkward, but like, I feel like that's kind of really doing myself justice, is like really insisting. It's like, if you could just give a ballpoint figure for your budget, that would be great. So yeah, I know that money is hard to talk about, but I almost think about it as like, you're just doing justice for yourself, right? Like that's how I think of it. Like not as like this arbitrary, like scary business thing and like, oh, I don't want to offend X person. Like that person is most likely not going to be offended. I don't think I've ever really had anyone who's been like downright offended by me quoting a figure. But the best outcome is like, I guess what you have to think about is like the best outcome of you being confident and like quoting a price that you feel is representative of your work is that you are doing yourself justice and you are helping yourself build a business that will last for years and years and years.
So. Yes to everything you said. I was nodding like yes, because that's exactly the way that I work as well. Because mm-hmm. I think about a project for ages, but the actual execution, I mean, hopefully none of my clients will listen to this, but it can be like 5 minutes, but not always. If it's very simple,
Let's censor this section. I'll be like, it takes me beep, this 2 minutes.
That's a really good idea. Yeah, and I think about a project for ages. Like I think sometimes it comes out very quickly and sometimes it doesn't. And I just didn't like, yeah, the whole day rate thing. I think it's important for me to figure out, okay, how many days it would take me at the day rate. And then especially the longer you are in business, you can up it, but I never share my day rate. It's kind of like, as I do my little calculation, but again, I always ask for budget up front too. And I'm not as persistent. I would say I don't always get it. So I'm definitely going to be way more persistent now and being like, just pushing for it. But yeah, I definitely have had friends that have worked in jobs where they're like told, you know, on a piece of paper, like don't tell them the budget, you have to ask them what they would charge like first before you give it away. So I think that's helped me to be like, okay, I'm just going to keep pestering them. And then no, I think that that's really, really sound advice. And again, I think charging on value based as well, I love the way that you worded that. It's so important, because just because you can do something maybe a bit quicker doesn't take away, it doesn't change the value. And again, like you said, that the bigger the company, the more value it will be for that company. And I always like taking on small projects as well, to and have like a little, if I can, if I have availability, it's something I really want to do. I'd love to do a bakery.
Wouldn't that be so cute? Yeah, like a little happy croissant.
Oh. I could see you doing a little illustrations for a bakery. So yeah, thank you. Think it's a mixture, isn't it? I think if it's something you really want in your portfolio, I'm happy to go. Especially at the beginning, I was happy to negotiate on that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've never had anyone respond badly to a price. I have had some people ask me though, that they have had bad experiences actually with people responding to prices. And especially artists starting out, I might have had like a few experiences that I've erased from my memory.
You're like, that is
thinking
gone.
About it now. Yeah. Someone in the DMs trying to get a t-shirt for really low amount and things like that. Do you have any advice for difficult conversations with clients or knowing what you're worth?
Yeah, that's a really good one. And yeah, thinking about it now, I have had a few, not funnily enough, not necessarily, I haven't had anyone kind of come back to me being like, how dare you ask about the budget, but more just that they've had the audacity to approach me in the first place being like, oh, you know, like this is a really cool thing, but like we don't have a budget, or like, oh, you know, this would give you great exposure. And I feel like that's kind of in the same vein, right? Because, you know, I get it. Like I've been there starting out wanting to take those opportunities. And I think you know, I'm not discouraging people from like outright rejecting all those kinds of jobs if they feel like it's worth it, or if they feel like, actually, you know what, like I'll make an exception, I do want to do that, that's, you know, that's fine, it's up to you, right? But I think the bottom line is that you should never feel like you owe them to do it, right? Like you don't owe them anything. These people coming into your DMs, like your artwork is worth so much more than those people who are sliding in trying to get free opportunities. And it's like, you should never have to feel grateful that someone is acknowledging your work, you know? Like I feel like there's that thing where it's like, oh wow, like someone's acknowledged that I'm creating artwork and like they think it's so good that they want to work with me. That's like for sure. But also if they actually respect you as like a business and a person and the effort and the time and the value of your work, then they would give you like the appropriate budget and they would be respectful towards you. So, you know, on a more tangible level, I guess, in terms of like how I would respond to that, you know, I do sometimes still get messages being all about exposure and all that shit, but sorry, I need to sense myself. I swear too much in real life. It's so hard to, and now I know lots of swear words in Portuguese as well, so I just like interchange. I'm like swearing in Portuguese, swearing in English.
It's absolutely fine.
Okay, oh, that's fine. I've been told off before by swearing. I swore on like a radio show and they were just like,
sometimes it slips out. You ever
thank you. Yeah,
sometimes I say it when I like almost bump into a child or something. And
Yeah,
I just like can't stop.
Exactly, I'm saying. Oh, especially around children, it's so bad. I feel so guilty. Oh God, I'm so glad I'm not alone with that. Thank you. Yeah, sorry. To backtrack. Yeah, so when I actually receive a message like that, the way that I answer, I'll always keep it really polite. I'll just be like, thanks so much for reaching out. Unfortunately, I don't take any unpaid work. It's like, that's just my generic response. Like you don't need to gratify them with like a huge long answer. You do not need to explain yourself. Like if they want to know why, like, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to go and imagine something, because I'm not wasting my time and energy explaining to you why I don't take unpaid work. That's just the fact. So I'll leave it. I'll just be like really quick and snappy. Sorry, I don't take any unpaid work. If I'm feeling particularly sassy that day, then I may also be like, you know, in the future, if you're approaching any creative, please understand that, you know, not having a budget or asking for unpaid work is, you know, undervaluing our labor. In the future, I would advocate a budget to whoever you approach. Thanks, kind regards, and whatever.
Yeah, so. Love that. I say exactly the same. I think I say something like, unfortunately, I cannot afford to work for free at this moment. Kind regards. Yeah, and it's like automated. And I guess it's one of those things that's like, I've learned as a creative business that businesses have like almost generic automated responses to things like that. And yeah, having just a generic response, I think, saves me like the mental space to like think about it even more and just be like, that's the end of that, and move on. And yeah, it's such a, I think it happened for me more so when I was starting out, for sure. And I think as soon as I got some clients and things started to work out and be, I guess, more regular work with big clients, and that's when it like all of a sudden stops. So it's just frustrating, because I think when you're starting out, you don't know the ins and outs, and you feel like, should I do this? Like, is this a good opportunity? Like, shall I do it? But I think I always say to people, it's way better to make work for your portfolio or personal projects, so you can build a portfolio that you can send out to your dream clients. And that is way more of a better better way to spend your time than with a client who is disrespecting you in that way.
Yeah.
And you also, I feel like there might be a chance later down the line that they might come back with a budget if you're like, no. I've definitely said no to things when they said there's no budget, and they've, oh, I have just found this £200 away. Ground, like, what is that doing there?
Oh my god, I can't believe that they actually came back to you being like, so guess what, you know, like, I just get
mainly for like speaking things,
right?
I get that. That you're just like, no, I'm not doing it if it's not paid. And then you know, so I think don't be afraid to say no, go work on some personal work, and then send that to clients that you know will actually pay you.
Feels like so basic, doesn't it? It's like, it does. To be paid or not to be paid, like, god, like, in what other industry do we have to have these kind of conversations again and again, right?
100%. But I feel like the creative industry is, unfortunately, there is so much about who you know, and so I think networking and like making those connections is so important.
Yeah.
And so knowing when, like, okay, I'm going to say no to this thing is really important, especially for your mental health and to be respected. And I think like what I have seen, and I've helped people through tough situations, a client that starts off disrespectful in that way, it just gets worse and worse and worse.
Yes, yes,
yes. It's like 100%. A red flag, isn't it?
It is, because it's a relationship. You know, when you start a project with a client, like, you're entering into a relationship, no matter if it's like one day or like 3 months. And so, yeah, if you see red flags that say, you know, this person's not going to treat you well, the likelihood is that they will be a really terrible client to work with. So better to pull out early and save yourself the hassle.
100%. Okay, I have a question for you on how do you think the creative industry can become more accessible for disabled creatives?
This is a really good question. It's something that I feel like I'm constantly thinking about, just navigating through the creative industry and like dealing with a lot of different clients from like different walks of life. I think the main thing that I've been thinking about a lot in relation to accessibility is the way that we conceive accessibility feels very basic in the creative industry. It's like, you know, things that revolve around physical disability and like actual physical spaces. So like, you know, making sure that buildings are accessible for wheelchair users and people who have mobility aids, you know, reaching specific rooms and making sure the spaces are able to fit those people into them in a way that's comfortable. But one thing that I think is not really explored in that much detail, and we're still kind of failing on those fronts even, so there's a lot to happen in that realm. But one thing that I don't really see spoken about a lot, or if at all, is how to make projects accessible from a project management perspective. One thing that I've come up against quite a few times, just in my career as an illustrator, that's felt very frustrating and demoralizing is when, you know, often I'm brought onto projects that center around disability. That's kind of, I guess, like what I'm known for, and I'm more than happy to do those kinds of projects, of course. But then I will find that, you know, sometimes the client will expect a really fast turnaround and they're like, please and thank you, you know. And there's no reflection on what it means to hire a disabled creative and how you make accommodations in terms of actually how the project is managed. And when I say project management, I'm saying things like timelines, you know, making sure that the timelines are accommodating for people who, you know, might experience fatigue or like have a cognitive disability or whatever it is, to make sure that they have enough time, enough space for resting and breaks, and to actually make the deadline without overexhausting themselves. That's something that I've had to push back against a lot. I've specifically found this to be a huge problem in publishing. I've had multiple projects. You're like, oh yeah, I see you. Oh, that's funny. Yeah, I've had quite a few projects where I've had to really push back on timelines and be like, look, like this, like for anyone, this is not okay. You know, illustrators or creators full stop should not be made to pull all-nighters to get their work in. That's not feasible and that's not okay. And it's not a way to expect people to work. But in particular, when you are hiring disabled creatives, you do not want to make them do these kinds of things, because then also, you know, they have their health to consider in, and, you know, there could be real life repercussions that happen then and there from literally just not project managing with your creatives in mind. You know, unfortunately, I had an experience quite recently where I was expected to meet really, really ridiculous deadlines, and the stress of it has actually given me what I think is a new MS symptom, which is really frustrating for me. So I actually had to leave that project, and I'm kind of just in the middle of tending to myself and figuring out what to do next from that perspective. But, you know, I think that this is one of the biggest frontiers for accessibility and making the creative industry more disability friendly, and specifically as, you know, more and more people are becoming chronically ill and disabled from, as we know, from COVID and a whole host of other stuff as well. And so it's really important that we consider these things when we do hire disabled creatives, but also when we don't. A positive example that I'd like people to take into account is that I am working on a really great project at the moment. And before I actually started the project with this unnamed company, the first thing that they said to me was, hi, Nanya. So we actually did some research about MS and your conditions. And we realized that fatigue and X, Y, and Z are, you know, a really common symptom. And so we want to make sure that the way that we work with you honors your needs. Like, how best would you like to work with us? Like, what can we do to accommodate you? And I was so touched, I think I almost cried, because that was the first time that anyone had done that. And it shouldn't be like, that should be what every single person does. And it's such an easy thing to do. And it meant that, you know, going forward, I've had such a great relationship with this client and like a really great time on the project, because I know that the timelines have like built in breaks for me. They will never contact me after working hours because I'm very strict about when I work. I get like, after they give me feedback, every single time there's the weekend, so I have that break, and it feels so much better. And like, I'm not constantly having to like renegotiate what the project looks like, because they've already done the research. And I think that that's kind of what we should expect of each other anyway. It's just like, as a society, there are so many millions of people with disabilities, chronic illnesses. And so like a baseline should be doing research about who you're working with, asking them how they would prefer to work with you before you decide timelines. So there should always be that flexibility. But I just find like often because, you know, sometimes I find that creative projects and illustration projects are kind of like a really last minute thing. They're like, oh God, yeah, the illustration for this thing. Like, I forgot, put a budget together, like call someone, you know? And so there's only like a few days, there's only a week, and it's kind of an afterthought. And I think we need to kind of really pull that back and start to like force people to project manage creative projects better. Because, you know, if people are able to do that on the other side of things, like, you know, where companies are creating stuff that doesn't necessarily require creatives, like if that's all on time, then so should creative projects.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. And I got, you know, emotional when you said that about that client that emailed that way. But that, again, is like, is the bare minimum. And I think it just makes so much sense. And it shows that the companies who are, however they're doing it, I don't know what the business lingo is, with like they're making sure that either there's what is it, HR, or like there's good processes for people to understand all these intersections of different people's experiences, that they're just, I think it's just going to work better for everyone all round.
Yes.
And I think it's so stressful as the creative to be like the last one on the list to be spoken to once everything else has been finalized. And like they say, oh yeah, you could do these like 100 illustrations in 2 weeks. That's fine, right? That's cool. And I think it just goes with this whole like notion that creativity is so like mysterious, and like there's not much understanding on like what it takes to be an artist. And sure, we need time to think about the creative. I need time to think about things creatively. I need breaks. And
yep,
I can't imagine what it, you know, it's so important that if I, you know, to include different people's experiences within that, I think that that's wonderful. And I, yeah, hopefully is it just with like having conversations with clients that we could do that? How do you feel like, what can people like do to help the creative process and like a fight for change in those kinds of things?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because like I'm a big believer in systemic change being the most important, but at the same time, you know, like I feel like because I feel like I have quite an established voice already, and like I get hired for illustration jobs because they know that I'm an activist and I'm really vocal, and like they want that to be a part of what I create. And so I think that that gives me some leeway to voice concerns in ways that perhaps, you know, artists and illustrators who are specifically starting out like might not feel comfortable doing, and also might have like actual unfortunate tangible effect on their careers, right? So like, you know, on a personal level, like I'm more than happy to continue speaking up, but then from a structural perspective, I think that we need to start to integrate more intersectional practices like within companies, organizations, institutions that affect every single level, because it can't just be like the tail end of like a project where the illustrator or the creative comes in that's changed. It has to be for everybody. I think one thing that I find really interesting and like definitely worth, you know, if people are curious about it, is like the principles of universal design and thinking about designing things that can look like buildings, or it can be like products, but it can also be, I think, like projects as well, with keeping in mind all the different needs of many, many diverse kind of groups of people, so that it is accessible for everybody. And that's something that I've been learning about a lot through a specific project that I'm working on now. But I think that if we thought about, you know, project management from that perspective, and thinking about like, you know, if we're thinking about disabled people, like how do we create project management practices that are good for disabled people and that center their needs, the effect is that that will be good for everybody else too. because you're taking into account those with like the most marginalized needs, and so the majority is positively affected by it too. Because it's like, it's not fair that like you know Natalie might have to go through being on a project where you're forced to like rush something, and just because you're not, you know, chronically ill or disabled doesn't mean that that's not hard for you. Like, you shouldn't have to go through that. It's not like, it sucks that that's a normalized practice for anyone. And so I think that that has to be challenged at every level, not just from a disability perspective, but just understanding that the repercussions for disabled people can be so much more immediate.
100%. And I've read about companies, if I remember the article, I'll put it in the description, but I read about how when companies do make efforts and like really become more intersectional and put a lot of money into like working that into their company as a bonus thing, but I know businesses care about this, so it does actually usually equate to like really good profit. And I think that that's something that people just don't know. Thank you so much for taking the time to. So it is Earth Day, and so I'd love to ask you about your Greenpeace comic.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been working with Greenpeace recently. They've just launched a campaign called the Big Plastic Count, which is where they are essentially encouraging people to count plastic in their homes, and then essentially to lobby the government and hold the government accountable, as well as corporations who produce plastic accountable, for how much plastic is not recycled in the UK and what's to be done about it. And so ahead of that campaign, I really wanted to work with Greenpeace to create a comic that addresses some of the things that certainly I feel, and a lot of people in the disabled community have felt, has not ever really been addressed in environmental campaigns, in particular plastic campaigns, around, you know, how plastics are not just kind of like wasteful for everyone, and that for a lot of people, it's not just important for quality of life, but actually it can make the biggest difference in terms of like your independence and whether you're able to actually, you know, like get out of bed in the morning. For a lot of members of the disabled community, there are so many reasons why it's really difficult to cut back on plastics, and like in a sense, they shouldn't really have to make those sacrifices. So the comic really talks about that, and is a conversation between a non-disabled friend and a disabled friend, and they're discussing plastic, why and how it can be more inclusive when we actually create campaigns that talk about plastic usage, and how to envision it. I think most excitingly, how to envision a future where we are thinking about plastic waste, but we're doing it from an inclusive perspective, where we are putting in alternatives that are universally designed. That means that the disabled community can actually use them, rather than just be expected to use reusable items that are not fit for use. So yeah, that's on the Greenpeace website, and also on the Big Plastic Counts disability page as well.
I love that. I'll leave that links below, and that is such a conversation that I think is so important when we talk about change, and especially changing behavior, that it's so different for different people with different experiences, and it's so important, especially with when people are passionate. Sometimes it can be like this, like we have to just remember to not be narrow-minded, and I think the comic does a wonderful way of communicating that, especially with a conversation with friends, because it can feel like it's a lovely way to share that knowledge, which is like watching a conversation unfold through two people who care for one another. So yeah, I'll leave that link below. Definitely check it out if you're listening. Do a quick fire round that I've prepared. This podcast is for aspiring creatives who want to go places. What's the best advice that you could give to them?
I would say, follow your gut. Like I feel like I've kind of been around in so many different jobs and careers, because I was almost like denying what I really wanted. Like I feel like all along I really knew that I wanted to be in something more creative, and I feel like there are so many like different things that might influence our decisions, like, you know, our parents sometimes, like societal expectations and what we think we're good at or what we don't want to try because maybe we're scared that you won't be able to make money from it. But it's always worth it to trust your gut instinct, to really feel like, I think it's so special to be able to look at your work and feel like, this is what I'm passionate about. This really represents who I am as a person, and people are really enjoying it. So I just think, like, you know, don't give up. You know, we're not built to get things right in one go. And I know that that's really hard, and there are a lot of perfectionists out there, and I'm definitely a recovering perfectionist myself. Is to just let yourself fail. I don't like using that word, but like, let yourself not get it right however many times. Like, there are often times even now, like, I don't necessarily get it right, and that's fine, it's just the way it is. And to just be forgiving of yourself. I feel like when I was younger and I wanted to go into the creative industry, I did not even give myself the chance to even try it because I was like, I'm already not good enough. So I let that stop me, and I feel like if I could go back and redo that, I would have been kinder to myself about that. The last thing I'd really recommend is just reaching out to your favorite illustrators and creatives, because, you know, we're all really nice bunch of people. And the way that I started to kind of get, I don't want to like get networked and like make friends in illustration, because I just like go into people's DMs or like email them and be like, I really love your work and I'm such a big fan and I like how you do this and that, and you know, I'm new and blah blah blah. And I've always found that people be like, oh my god, you know, like any questions that you have, like, we're in general, I feel like we're such a helpful, cute community. You know, we always want to like help uplift each other, and especially people just coming into it. So yeah, don't be afraid to reach out to people, because we're all here to help each other.
I love that. And absolutely, I think that that's great advice. Who are your top inspirations?
I would say you, definitely.
Shut up.
No, it's true. It's definitely
no
true.
No way. Oh, you're making
No, for real. I've been such a fan for like a really long time, and then I was like, okay, I'm gonna like message her and see what happens.
That's so funny. I did not tell her to say that.
No, this was like an unpaid ad for Natalie. So
I'll just take that little clip.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, but for I really mean it. Like, I think your work is amazing, and I love how you weave all your personal experiences and like are so emotionally vulnerable and talk about mental health, and it's brilliant. And women's health is very important as well. I feel like another all-time favorite is Samantha Mash. She's a US-based illustrator. I just really love the way that she draws, like creates artwork around women, and like I feel like she has this like amazing way of like creating these beautiful like sharp lines. Like, her color palettes are just absolutely gorgeous, and she was one of the first people that really inspired me to becoming an illustrator. I was just like, wow, your work is so cool. So that's another person. I'm trying to think who else I want to name. Yes, Ashley Lukashevsky. Do you know her? I really like her.
I'm better at knowing the artwork than I am actual names, so I'll leave all the links in the description for everyone you mentioned.
Do you know what it is for me as well? I had to quickly scroll to Instagram because I just know people's Insta handles. I was like, okay, what's their actual bloody name? So yeah, Ashley Lukashevsky. I really like their work because they are very like community focused. They basically do a similar thing to me and integrate like their artwork with the activism and create some like amazing pieces for like local communities. And I just love that there's that like overwhelming kind of focus on that. And yeah, I'm a big fan as well. And I don't know if I can think of anyone else off the top of my head. I'm going to have a quick scroll.
It's so many. I always feel like so it's funny. Hard to just name someone quickly.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm just trying to think.
Do you have any from your childhood, like any art that you saw when you were little? You're like, that's cool.
Yes. Okay. I'm going to go back to like my dino nerd self, I was always a really big fan of James Gurney, who is a paleo artist, and he actually created the books called Dinotopia. it's amazing because it's like these people end up on this island, and the island is like where humans and dinosaurs coexist, and it's super cute, and they have like societies together.
I think I know what book you mean. I feel like I can see it. What's the best trick you have for creative block?
Actually, spend time away from whatever's blocking you. Like if I stare for like 1,000 years at the thing, like I know I'm just never going to get it done. So I like to take time to like do things that make me feel good, like a bit of self-care. Like I might go and do some yoga, I might go for a walk, but I will spend all of that time away from the thing, because often I find that creative block is actually maybe burnout, maybe you're feeling exhausted and overwhelmed. That's when I find that I get creative block. So that usually means to me, take a long break, do what you need to do to get yourself centered, rest, look after yourself, and then come back to the thing.
Love that. What's the best advice that you ever received?
The best advice I ever received. Let's see. I think for me, it was take the leap, because I was so scared of moving from like my stable office job to becoming an illustrator. And I was just told, just take the leap. Like, it's scary, but just do it. And that was hands down the best thing I've ever done for myself, is just taking that leap to becoming an illustrator full time. I'm so happy.
Oh, I love that. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me. I've learned so much in this episode, and I really enjoyed speaking to you about all of these things. And I think we'll end it there on that little happy note.
Amazing. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. It's such a fun conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Please follow Ananya and go through the links in the description. To follow Ananya and her amazing work, please check out her Instagram. All the links will be in the description. To find more about me and advice on your creative path, you can head to my Patreon. There's loads of episodes, over 50 episodes now, that are very specific to different things if you run a creative business or if you are an aspiring creative. Thank you so much to Ananya for taking the time to speak to me and sharing all this amazing wisdom. And you will see and hear from me in the next episode. Bye-bye.